Peter B. Collins, news and comment. It's Tuesday, September 11th, 2018. And once again, on this annual basis, we confront the myths, the contradictions, and the deception of the official narrative of September 11th, 2001. And I know when I talk about this, some people start to squirm. You cringe and you say, Peter, I have questions, but, you know, the mainstream narrative is so cemented. Everybody believes it. And I don't want people to think I'm crazy for questioning the official story of 9/11. Well, I've come to terms with that. I recognize that some people think I am crazy, a tinfoil hat conspiracy theorist who just will not rest, will not trust my government. And those are fair characterizations. I have been challenging the lies and cover-ups of the United States government since I first became a radio talk show host back in 1972. And I continue to this day on very solid footing. Now, when it comes to 9/11, there are people who say, Peter, how can you argue the airplanes hit the buildings and the buildings fell down? End of story. Well, we know that no airplane hit Building 7, and it was demolished in less than 10 seconds at 5:20 in the afternoon on September 11th. And I've interviewed Professor Stephen Jones, who lost his job at Brigham Young University because he published peer-reviewed studies revealing the particles of nanothermite that were found in the debris at the World Trade Center in multiple locations. And so, my studied position on 9/11 is this. After reviewing the work in person of the 9/11 Commission in Washington, reading their report, and reading some of the excellent work of David Ray Griffin and others challenging that official narrative, what I know is that the official story is not true. And it does not hold up to close inspection and just simple physics. There are also so many issues with the timelines, with who said what to whom and when. And Trump today went to Shanksville, Pennsylvania, where he stumbled through a teleprompter speech filled with platitudes and continued the ritual exploitation of the events of 9/11 for the gateway that they provide to the surveillance state, the police state, torture, endless war, and many other issues that have been, well, they've become the new normal. And tonight, I will once again be attending and be moderating a portion of the 9/11 Film Festival in Oakland, across the bay from me. And I want to thank Ken Jenkins and Carol Brue and many other stalwarts who continue to press for the truth about September 11th. And when I see Trump in Shanksville repeating this story about the alleged heroic passengers on Flight 93, there may have been moments of heroism on that flight, but the cell phone calls were not technologically possible at the time. And there's just so many other contradictions. And then there are the two separate sources I have talked to over the last 17 years who confirm that they were in the loop. They were monitoring the most secure radio channel used by Dick Cheney at the White House on September 11th. And both of these individuals confirm that they heard the order given by Cheney to shoot down Flight 93. And so when people are confronted by this testimony, this information that contradicts what the media has cemented into place, the myth that passes as the official narrative, I know it makes a lot of people uncomfortable. But consider how some of the greatest journalists in the United States today won't touch the 9/11 story. Oh, it's radioactive, man. It's more dangerous than the toxic chemicals in the hot metal liquid that remained at the World Trade Center for days, if not weeks, after September 11th. And so it's kind of a perfect circle where the government promotes a narrative, the media embraces it, doesn't challenge it, and a passive public accepts it. And this, as I say, has been the gateway to so many ill effects, misdeeds, bad decisions, and policy changes. And I just got an email today that David Ray Griffin, the theologian, who has written, I've lost count, at least 10 books about September 11th. He and a co-author, Elizabeth Woodworth, have just published 9/11 Unmasked. And I don't have a copy yet. I certainly will get one and review it. But the chapters cover the destruction of the Twin Towers and Building 7, the attack on the Pentagon, the 9/11 flights, military exercises on and before 9/11, the military and political leaders, Osama bin Laden and the hijackers, the phone calls that I mentioned a moment ago from the 9/11 flights, and the question of insider trading. There's also a new book out that I have and I've started to read, and I do plan to interview the authors. It's called The Watchdogs Didn't Bark, subtitled The CIA, NSA, and the Crimes of the War on Terror. The co-authors are John Duffy and Ray Novoshelsky, I think is how he pronounces his name. And I interacted with these gentlemen back in about 10 years ago when they embarked on the research that has culminated in this book. And they had produced a video where they identified a woman who worked for the CIA, who was central to many of the programs that we consider to be war crimes. Her name is Alfreda Frances Bukowski. And when she was named in their film, they got huge pushback from the CIA. They said, she's covert, you can't do that. Well, I took the risk and I revealed her name. And nothing has ever happened. It was another one of those efforts to silence us and to keep us from poking into places we should be able to poke into. And last year, one of my sources, a former CIA officer, tipped me off that Alfreda Bukowski, in 2014, married Michael Scheuer. Now, this takes me back to 2004-2005. Michael Scheuer was very controversial. He published a book about the 9/11 episodes and the conflicts between the CIA and the NSA. The book was published under the name Anonymous. Does that bring back any memories? And then Scheuer went on to publish a couple of books under his own name. I interviewed the guy 6 or 7 times, and he was always unfailingly polite. Mr. Collins, yes, sir. Very smart guy. He ran the bin Laden desk for the CIA. And he named it Alec after one of his sons. And so today, I just did a little lookup on Michael Scheuer, and there's an article from July of this year by Jonathan Hudson at Salon.com. And Michael Scheuer is still alive and well. I haven't been in touch with him in years. But here's the opening paragraph of this article about Scheuer. Suppose there were a best-selling author, historian, essayist, public speaker, TV commentator, advisor to Ron Paul, secessionist advocate, Christian nationalist, Vladimir Putin apologist, an expert on terrorism, who was married to a senior intelligence official. Suppose he were a frequent commentator on an influential radio show with close ties to Donald Trump, his family, and his administration. Suppose this Trump-connected radio show routinely directed its listeners to this man's blog, on which he wrote it was quite near time for well-armed citizens who voted for Trump to kill those seeking to impose tyranny. of whom there was a long and very precise list, including journalists, activists, pundits, abortion providers, Republican and Democratic elected officials, federal judges, law professors, FBI agents, intelligence officials, and Justice Department people too, along with all those who support them. And the journalist says, there is such a man and such a show, and the man is Michael Frank Scheuer, former CIA intelligence official, author of 4 books, and this is amazing and chilling to hear. Now, he's aligned with a guy named John Fredericks, who provides a radio platform. Donald Trump has been on the Fredericks radio show 8 times, along with many members of his campaign team and his family. Now, what's fascinating is I went to Scheuer's blog, and I'll link to all this in the show file for today's podcast so you can click along with me. But over at the blog, on July 14th, he wrote, American patriots have so far, praise God, been remarkably disciplined in not responding to tyranny and violence with violence. For now, they must remain so, armed but steady. But the time for such patience is fast slipping away. Indeed, that patience is quickly becoming an obviously rank and self-destructive foolishness. If Trump does not act soon to erase the above-noted tyranny and tyrants, the armed citizenry must step in and eliminate them. But here's some evidence that Michael Scheuer is an unpredictable cat, because I found a blog post from March of this year. At the time, news had surfaced that John Bolton might be named National Security Advisor by Trump. And Scheuer minced no words. God damn you, President Trump. John Bolton is an Israel-first neocon warmonger and a lethal enemy of our republic. He said Bolton is anti-American shitbird. So check this stuff out. It just shows that the people who failed us on 9/11 were never held responsible. Many of them were promoted. Michael Scheuer still has outsized influence in the whole world shaped by September 11th. And at The Guardian today, there's a good profile of the people who've paid the biggest price for September 11th. Those are the people who were exposed to the toxic residue. And for example, they cite John Moore Mando, who has received a diagnosis of breast cancer, and he's not alone. There are other men who were exposed to the toxic fumes and the dust and debris who've also been diagnosed with breast cancer. Michael Geddes, a retired NYPD sergeant who rushed to Ground Zero and then worked at the Fresh Kills landfill on Staten Island where the debris were taken. He was diagnosed with breast cancer 3 years ago, and he's been treated with surgery, chemotherapy, and radiation. 65-year-old Jeff Flynn, also diagnosed with breast cancer. He worked for a data storage company near the World Trade Center. And all these people were told that it was safe to return to so-called Ground Zero. Now, there are almost 10,000 people who were certified members as having cancer related to the event and entered into the World Trade Center Health Program. And 420 additional people who had cancer have died. In all, more than 43,000 people have been certified with 9/11 related health conditions. 182 members of the fire department alone have died due to such illnesses. And it was Christine Todd Whitman, the EPA director, former governor of New Jersey, ordered by George W. Bush to say everything's okay, who did so. And it took her years to walk that back. And my friend Brian Donahue forwarded a message from School of America's Watch, because September 11th is a day of infamy. Going back 45 years to 1973, September 11th was the date of the CIA-backed coup d'etat in Chile that overthrew the elected government of socialist Salvador Allende. It led to the 17-year military dictatorship of General Augusto Pinochet, resulting in the murder and enforced disappearance of more than 3,000 people, detention and torture of 38,000, and the exile of more than 200,000 Chileans. And let's not forget, September 11th of 2012 was the night of infamy at the U.S. facilities in Benghazi, Libya. And I continue to believe that there was a cover-up of that event because the CIA base that was not, was not adjacent to the scene of the violence, the protests that led to the death of the ambassador and three others. No, that CIA safe house was being used to grab guns from Gaddafi's arsenal and ship them to the war in Syria. And that's why Obama and Clinton and the team, facing the election just 6 weeks away, decided to, allow the CIA to dictate a cover-up. That's the way I saw it playing out. And meanwhile, the war drums in Syria get louder and louder. As we are told, the last vestige of Islamic State territory is under attack from four different directions. And that is the town of Hajin, Syria. And this gets so Orwellian. The New York Times reports, the Syrian Democratic Forces, the Kurdish-led militia that's been fighting the Islamic State with the United States and its allies, said that its forces had launched an offensive from four sides on Monday evening. Now, we know that the Syrian Democratic Forces are not Syrian and they're not democratic. And that Obama spent 5 years searching for the moderate rebels in Israel who could beat the Islamic State and overthrow the Assad government all at the same time. It was a fool's errand. But now we have to deal with Trump, and he said he had a secret plan to vanquish the Islamic State. We've never heard any more about that. But in the last 2 weeks, he apparently has shifted his position two to three times about Syria. That may have been the trigger for the anonymous op-ed in the New York Times last week. And so, according to the Veteran Intelligence Professionals for Sanity, and a memo that they issued on September 9, quote, we are concerned that you may not have been adequately briefed on the upsurge of hostilities in northwestern Syria, where Syrian armed forces with Russian support have launched a full-out campaign to take back the al-Nusra al-Qaeda ISIS-infested province of Idlib. The Syrians will almost certainly succeed as they did in Aleppo in late 2016, and as in Aleppo, it will mean unspeakable carnage unless someone finally tells the insurgents theirs is a lost cause. And these are our insurgents. Together with the Emirates and the Saudis, we have covertly funded and supported these efforts for years. And so the intelligence professionals say, we believe your senior advisors are encouraging the insurgents to think in those terms, that you will turn around and rain hell down on Damascus. And they go on to say your most senior aides are taking credit for your recent policy shift from troop withdrawal from Syria to indefinite war. So I take that alarm seriously. And there's also very interesting inoculation messaging in Russian media right now. I've told you about this previously, but they are trying to inoculate the public in the event that we see reports of a chemical weapons use in Idlib. And RT asserts several Middle East TV channels and a U.S. news channel have been sent to Jisr al-Shughur in Syria's Idlib governorate to produce the footage needed for the provocation. That according to a statement by the Russian Center for Syrian Reconciliation. Quote, all the footage of the staged provocation in Jisr al-Shughur is to be delivered to the newsrooms of TV channels which are to broadcast it after its publication on social media. The Russian military said the footage would include scenes of white helmet operatives treating supposed victims of an apparent barrel bomb chemical weapon attack by the Assad government. Now, I find this fascinating. We saw something similar before the Duma episode, where we were told chemical weapons and nerve agents were used earlier this year. And so we will watch and wait but I find this fascinating and also just a little grisly. Every day I pause for a second to thank the people who support my work here at the Peter B. Collins Podcast with your subscriptions. Find people like Peter J. Hoffmeister, Jason Ferguson, Janet Price, and Margaret Anderson. I want to thank each of you for your support. And Peggy Anderson, she was in touch with me recently, and I know she is quite a solid, loyal supporter of this podcast. Will you join them? I hope so. I invite you to do it right now. Pause the podcast. Go to peterbcollins.com. You click on menu, then click on become a subscriber. You land on the sign-up page, and boom, you can choose $5, $10, $20 a month or the $50 annual subscription. And if you take out the annual with a mailing address in the continental U.S., you get the bonus gift, John Dist's new rock and roll CD, American University. Well, one of the other kind of trickle-down effects of September 11th is the militarization of the police response in this country and the surveillance apparatus that has been expanded and was solidified under Obama. And over at Shadowproof, a reporter named Will Pierce exposes what's going on in Evanston, Illinois. Now, I went to Northwestern, which is located in Evanston, just north of the city of Chicago, and I lived in Evanston after I left university and was working in radio, and I have a soft spot for that town. But the Evanston Police Department has signed a contract with Geofedia, which is a company that monitors social media by mapping location and other data. Geofedia has received funding from Incutel, which is the venture capital arm of the CIA. The company became infamous after the ACLU published a report 2 years ago on the use of their products by police to monitor demonstrations against police violence. So, Geofedia has been trying to drum up business with the Evanston Police Department for 5 years now, and the company, Geofedia, used an agreement with the neighboring police department in Skokie as a way to try to move Evanston to close a deal. And in April of this year, a FOIA request led to the release of a January 2014 contract between Evanston and Geofedia, and they were using these tools to monitor the social media activities of middle school students. Now that is a creeping police state. Surveillance plays a role in the latest effort by the Trump administration to punish the government in Beijing. As you know, the crackdown on the ethnic Uyghurs, who are minority Muslims in China, has been underway for many years. But there's been recent attention because of satellite photos that show what can be called concentration camps. The Chinese call them re-education camps. And this is a serious issue. But Trump sees it as an extension of his trade war with China and his effort to get China to force North Korea to go along with what Trump wants. So the Chinese Muslims in the camps are forced to attend daily classes, denounce aspects of Islam, study mainstream Chinese culture, and pledge loyalty to the Chinese Communist Party. It is parallel to the Soviet gulags. But Trump is now threatening sanctions. And I don't believe that he cares about the human rights of a single Uyghur. The situation is alarming. But Trump is so selective on human rights, for example, he hasn't made any comments I'm aware of about the brutal expulsion of Rohingya Muslims from Myanmar. He seems to think that that's not his business, and gosh, why would the United States want to try to preserve the lives of Rohingya Muslims in the former Burma? But it's our inconsistency that leaves us as a rogue nation that no one can trust. And in Egypt yesterday, an American citizen was sentenced to 15 years in prison. He says he was just walking by a protest demonstration in Cairo that occurred a few years back after the coup that took out the government that had been elected and installed General al-Sisi, who is running a military dictatorship that makes the Mubarak regime seem gentle in comparison. So the American citizen is Mustafa Kassem. And we're told Mike Pence raised his case with the Egyptians in a meeting last January, but they went ahead and convicted him, along with 75 Egyptians who got the death penalty. All of this for a protest on August 14th of 2013. And that's when the military crackdown occurred, and at least 817 Egyptians were killed by their own soldiers. Now, the real bitter irony here is that the conviction of the American Kassem occurred a day after the U.S. agreed to pony up another $1 billion in military aid to this repressive regime in Cairo. Today, I'm releasing an in-depth interview with my old friend Mark Perchuk. Mark is one of the leading people who changed the regulations and policies about tobacco use in this country when he was the co-founder of Americans for Non-Smokers' Rights. He now runs a group called Grassroots Change, and they have a service called Preemption Watch. And in this excerpt, Mark Perchuk describes how his experience with tobacco regulation has informed this latest extortion attempt that was successful, where the big soda companies cornered Governor Jerry Brown and said, look, we've got a ballot initiative and it's going to go unless you knuckle under and preempt any local soda taxes for the next 12 years. Here's an excerpt from my conversation with Mark Perchuk.
It causes a social change very similar to what happened with smoking 25 years ago. That is to say, a product that was accepted as a fine product, just a great product, like cigarettes were in 1910 in the United States, suddenly is under threat of being stigmatized because it's killing people. The soda industry saw this, and their response was to threaten a ballot initiative in this year, 2018, in November, that would radically reduce the ability of cities and counties in California to raise taxes for very fundamental services, police, fire departments. And so to answer your question, that threat was so real that the American Beverage Association and Pepsi and Coke took it to the governor and the legislature. And they said, look, we will take this off the ballot. We will drop this ballot measure if you preempt the authority of cities and counties in California over the next 12 years, which is a very long time in political terms. If you will preempt the ability of cities and counties in California to replicate the wonderful work that happened in Berkeley and that was on the way in places like Richmond and Stockton.
I invite you to listen to the full interview with Mark Perchuk. It's available for subscribers today at peterbcollins.com, at iTunes, TuneIn, Spreaker, and Stitcher. And by the way, activists have already filed the paperwork to run a statewide initiative to pass a California soda tax in 2020. So take that, big soda. Yesterday, I dinged the San Francisco Chronicle for its happy talk reporting on Jerry Brown's climate summit that's underway this week. And to their credit, today's headline on the front page reads, Climate Change Action – Bold Goals, Protests. And they do acknowledge the array of protesters who believe that Jerry Brown has not been effective enough on very direct issues related to climate change, fracking, oil licenses, the methane release at the Porter Ranch facility in Southern California. And speaking of methane, today, Scott Pruitt's agenda over at the EPA was declared complete because his successor, the former coal industry lobbyist whose name is Wheeler, he went ahead and rolled back the environmental regulations that Obama had signed off on, requiring some regulations to try to reduce or prevent the leaking of methane from oil and gas drilling operations. This is a major source of methane, which is a concentrated carbon emission that is 25 times more effective than basic carbon dioxide in trapping heat in the atmosphere. And about one-third of methane pollution is estimated to come from oil and gas operations. And when you connect this with the rollback of the regulations on vehicle emission standards and on smokestacks from coal-fired power plants, yes, Trump, with the help of Scott Pruitt, has made America a great polluter again. Thanks for listening to my daily news and comment podcast. You're free to share this far and wide, and you'll find it on YouTube. I'm Peter B. Collins.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails.